Fangoria has been at it for over 40 years and is better than ever. This magazine, it's not only gorgeous, it's highly collectible and delivered right to your front door four times a year. Each issue filled to the brim with articles exploring every nook and cranny of genre filmmaking, past, present, and future, with all the most exciting journalists, filmmakers, and horror know-it-alls to guide the way, including little old me from time to time. This high-quality writing will only ever appear within the physical pages of the magazine, never online, so if you want to join in on the fun, you're going to need to subscribe, and in order to do that, all you got to do is head on over to Fangoria.com and sign up, and if you use the code KINGCAST at checkout, you will save a gigantic 25% off of your subscription. That is Fangoria.com, code KINGCAST. Now on with the show.
Hi. My name is Stephen King.
He's gonna break!
Bedlam!
Bedlam! Sarah! You guys want to go see a dead body?
Well, sometimes that is better.
Welcome to the KingCast here on the Fangoria Podcast Network, where we geek out on the regular about the books, movies, and general aura of Stephen King. I'm Anthony Bresnikan.
His musk. We live in his musk, apparently. Let's try to get as creepy as we can in the intros. I'm gonna make that a goal in the year of our Lord 2026. I'm gonna try to creep him out as much. I'm Eric Vespi, by the way.
Yes, and Musk and nothing goes together like Musk and Stephen King, as we know from Twitter. And we are your hosts on this show that has already gone off the rails. But our guest today will bring us back. Our guest today is a true guide to the horror films of the past quarter century, Clark Collis. He's an old friend of mine. He was always the person I said was my favorite writer at Entertainment Weekly. When we worked there together, he always had the most original and unusual ideas to explore. He's an entertainment journalist now, freelancing, based in Britain, who I think you've worked for Empire, right, Clark? Guardian? Any other regular places that I should mention?
I'm just trying to think of places that are still in existence that I worked for. I wrote for the Daily Telegraph recently about when The Conjuring Last Rites came out, about visiting Lorraine Warren at a spooky house in Connecticut. And also pertinent to this podcast, I did a story for my old employer's Entertainment Weekly where I visited the set of The Running Man, which is written by Stephen King. I don't know if you gentlemen knew that, but...
Oh, it is. Yeah, it is, right?
Technically, Richard
Bachman, it was a different
Bachman,
author.
But
yeah.
We'll let that slide. We'll let it slide.
Sure.
Clark is now the author of this amazing book. It is called Screaming and Conjuring. It's a compendium of his knowledge about horror movies and interviews with the people who've made them over the past quarter century. The subtitle is The Resurrection, An Unstoppable Rise of the Modern Horror Movie. Of course, Stephen King turns up throughout, but sometimes in ways that are not what you would normally expect. Welcome, Clark Collis, to the KingCast.
Thank you so much. It is such an honor to be here.
And I mentioned the last time you appeared on the show, but for the constant listener, Clark is a big reason why the KingCast kind of took off at the beginning of its run, because when we launched the show, when Wampler and I launched the show back in the COVID lockdown era, there were about a trillion people starting podcasts, and somehow Clark still found us, liked us, and included us in the best podcast of the year list that he contributed to at Entertainment Weekly. And we got so much mileage out of that, Clark. And so, it really did help to kind of, establish us as not just, the average fan podcast that sprung up in that time. And so it was some bona fides that helped grease the wheels with a lot of publicists. So I really appreciate it.
I had listened to the podcast right from the start, and I felt, it certainly merited foregrounding to Entertainment Weekly listeners. But also the truth is that I knew that really, I just had to ask you two, one question, and then I could sit back and continue drinking. drinking whatever I was drinking in the depths of the podcast of the COVID situation.
Yep.
I knew it would be, I knew it would be both entertaining and for me quite easy copy. So I'm the one that should be thanking you guys.
Oh, well, we're happy to have scratched your back in however, whatever way we did. But you know that there's definitely a kindness that you know. Again, it was you know it's tough when you're starting any kind of endeavor, especially podcasting. Like I remember when we launched, like we were so psyched to hit like 2,000 listens or something. We're in a I got a notification from the podcast hosting service that it was we were more successful than 96% of all podcasts that have ever happened with like 2,000 listens in the first week, right?
Wow.
And you know, and thankfully the numbers have gone up from that. But yeah, I mean, it's just there's so much out there. I mean, especially then, you know. So again, any light shined really helped us out, and it was
But
very
you guys
cool, very
like,
nice. Yeah.
but you had great guests right from the start. I mean, I'm sorry that things have fallen so swiftly for you that
Look who came crawling
that
back
I
to
know
Clark
that
Collis.
I'm back. But the great thing was that you guys, you know, part, I mean, you know, partly because of your reputations and enthusiasms, and yes, also that people couldn't leave their house. I mean, you did have such great guests right from the start, and have carried that through to the present day. I saw that you had Karen Gillan on the show recently, and I haven't had a chance. I didn't have a chance to listen to that episode, but. So I'm a huge Doctor Who fan, and you know, so was kind of you know familiar with Karen Gillan right from that show, and then I went on the set of Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 1, and she was there, and I've never been more sure that a film was a tax write-off than watching James Gunn, who I knew from Sliver, which don't I say that. I adopt that tone not because it isn't a great movie. I love Slither, but had made about $3, and suddenly he was being, you know, entrusted with this. But so I got to know Karen a tiny little bit, and then I remember interviewing her in New York on the radio, and I'm like, I don't know, I'm like 5 foot 6, and she's considerably taller than that. And I think
She's
was
8 foot 2.
wearing, right? I think was wearing, I mean, to be, you know, not to be. Creepy, but you know, absolutely beautiful woman, but much taller than me. And I remember joking to her. We took a selfie, or the producer took a picture for publicity purposes. And I said, joking, 100% jokingly, I was like, "Could you scooch down a little bit so I don't look like such a short person?" And so I do have this photograph of me standing normally and her visibly like bending her knees.
Squatting
So that
beside you.
she, yeah, so that she even remotely looks like the same height as me,
Can you
which I
come
enjoy
back?
enormously. Yeah, it was much like that. But she's a,
In related
she's an
news, he will be
absolute.
remaking Lord of the Rings. She will be playing Gandalf.
It's all.
You are
It's all.
Frodo
I should have done false perspective, where I'm very much at the front, and then you know she's
Baggins.
like 18 feet back. But yeah, that was fun. I love her.
Yeah,
And actually, now I think about it, because she was on the show. And I'm sorry if this, I mean, I don't know why you thought I was going to get this back on track,
Oh,
this
no,
podcast. But you had Hiddleston on the show, right?
Yeah, we did.
And so I'll tell you, the one time I've seen Hiddleston in the flesh was the same day, basically, that I met Anthony, because
That's right.
Entertainment Weekly sent me to cover Warhorse, which was being shot in the UK, Steven Spielberg's film. And USA Today, was
That's where
it
I was at
Anthony?
the time, yeah.
Right, sent Anthony. And there are two things that I remember very clearly about that trip. So I was flying from New York overnight, red eye, big mistake. You should always take the day flight, but I was flying the red eye to London, get into London in the morning, book into our hotel. And what they'd done was we were going to have the set visit the next day. But that the play Warhorse
Yeah, we saw
was
the
still on,
play.
I think, at the National Theatre, and they got us tickets for that. And for those that don't know, in the play version of Warhorse, the horses are like massive puppets that are operated from underneath, I think, by people with like
They're almost like skeletons, like you can see the people inside, and they're just sort of like almost like sculptures of a horse rather than like a fur covered, hide covered horse.
But they're like horse sized, you
Yeah, they're
know.
gigantic. It's like four or
So,
five people,
yeah.
operating them.
And because I was jet lagged, I sat down, probably had a drink, and then 20 minutes in, just fell asleep at the National Theatre. And woke up and I had no idea where I was. I had no idea what I was doing. All I knew was that there were these massive puppet horses dancing around in front of me. And I was like, oh my God, I'm in hell or something, and then I remembered where I was. But then we drove down to the West Country the next day to see some shooting. And
I was in
I was,
Bath, wasn't it? Wasn't that, isn't that
I was, yeah, I was
near,
close to Bath.
isn't
It
that
was very
near
close to where I grew up. Yeah,
where you
yeah,
grew
yeah.
up? Yeah.
Yeah. Lovely. Yeah, they were shooting in some lovely village which they could easily recreate to be in the First World War. And we were driving down, and I was chatting to Anthony, and I'm pretty sure we hadn't met before, but I think
No.
Anthony had been was talk he was talking to one of the editors at Entertainment Weekly about possibly coming over. And Anthony
Yeah.
said to me, well, what's it like? And I must have been positive about it because then Anthony joined the staff soon afterwards. But the great thing about that, well, there are two great things about that. One of which is, even though we were in different offices for a long time, we got to, I mean, Anthony's a great guy and a great writer, and we got to, we got to utilize his skills at Entertainment Weekly. But the second thing was, I never had to write anything about Warhorse, which is a film I was really not that interested in covering because Anthony had been on set. So the Entertainment Weekly essentially had two writers on set in the end, and Anthony just took over and wrote it all. And so I had the experience of sitting at a round table, with what it's like, three or four other journalists, but sitting next to Steven Spielberg, which is like, I mean, the great thing about Steven Spielberg is he looks like Steven Spielberg. I mean, it's a hat, and it's just like he's just an iconic guy, and I
Yeah.
was sitting next to him. So I got to have that whole experience, and then I never had to write a word about it, which is really like one of the, it's possibly the best job at Entertainment Weekly I ever had. All the fun of,
You got to sleep through half a Warhorse in the play. It's like,
Yeah,
it's
you got a nap,
it
you got a drink, you got to see some.
was great.
I hope I didn't steal
Perfect.
it from you. I hope I wouldn't have done
Well,
that to you.
you did in the sense that I mean, you. No, I no. You didn't steal them. I was happy. Like, it's just one of those things. I was waiting for someone to ask me to write up my war horse notes, and nobody ever did. So I was like, great, no problem, no problem at all. No,
That's
that was fine. That was aces by me.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah, no, I mean, I've done a lot of Spielberg stuff over the years, but I certainly wouldn't want to bigfooted you. But that was a fun trip.
No.
That little village was I think they used that village in Dr. Doolittle, the 1960s
Right.
version, and it looks like a hobbit town. It's like these, it's got to be, I mean, what, 4 centuries old at least, something like that.
Yeah, that's my this built. I mean, if I sound blasé, the house I'm sitting in is 4 centuries old.
Oh,
So,
okay. Well, I
I
guess
mean, this
that's
is what
true.
you
In
know.
what do they say in England? That in the United States, 100 miles is a long time, and in England, 100 miles is a long distance.
Yes, no, absolutely, absolutely. They don't do road movies in England because you run out of road within like 90 minutes. So, but yeah, that was particular. And Richard Curtis was there as well. I remember the writer of Four Weddings and a Funeral, the director of Love Actually, who I think was doing either co-writing the script or
I
script
think he had done the
doctoring, or
screenplay,
yeah. And I remember seeing I didn't remember seeing Hiddleston sitting around somewhere, which is the very tangential link to this podcast.
It was Hiddleston was leading the charge of or the march of young men out of this town toward the Great War, which
Yeah.
they thought was going to be majestic, and that's the scene we were watching. So yeah, that's
Yeah.
right. That was Hiddleston. Yeah.
And they use real, to be clear, they do use real horses in the movie, so don't be surprised or alarmed if you're going to see War
I'm
Horse
pretty sure
and
Andy
there are
Serkis
real
played the
horses.
horse in War Horse. I'm
Yeah.
pretty sure. No. Yeah, no. It's a weird thinking back and listening to your guys' stories, and I was like, you know what? I think Hiddleston is going to be one of the most common actors that I've seen work, because I was at Ain't It Cool, the big nerd cornerstone site when during the rise of the MCU, right? So I went on, a lot of those Marvel sets, and so I remember clocking him for the first time. I must have been on Avengers or something, where they couldn't tell us fucking anything but they had all these people here. And there was a, and by the way, there was a progression of that, because in the early days, like, I went on Iron Man, Iron Man 2, Captain America, and Captain America, like, Feige walked us through a room that had storyboards up, visual cues, visual representations of everything that happened in the movie from frame one to the end, and was like, all right, this is all we're doing. And within a couple of movies after that, it was like, boom, like, you don't know shit. To the point where the one of the worst set visits I ever went on was Thor 2, and it wasn't, necessarily for any talent or anything, but they were shooting, the schedule had changed, and they were shooting things that we couldn't see. So we flew all the way to England to watch to essentially do these big to watch almost nothing. We got to see like 30 minutes of them filming something, and they wouldn't tell us the context of it. And the
Because
reason I
Thor 2 really required a lot of context, and
Well, and here's the thing, and this I figure I found out later what it was, but I clocked Hiddleston at one of these visits where he like nobody could talk about anything, and we would do these like a big almost like press conference style Q&As with them, right? And the way he would like eloquently talk about the character, about the progress of Loki as a, as a being in the universe, like whatever, he would artistically say nothing. Like he, but it would sound like it was so meaningful, and I'm like, wow, this guy has a big talent for this. And then I went to Crimson Peak, and they said, do you want to interview Hiddleston? And I said, absolutely, I want to interview Hiddleston. And they're like, great, go meet him at his trailer, just go knock on his trailer door. I'm like, one, I need somebody to guide me. I'm not just gonna walk up to Tom Hiddleston's trailer door and knock. And they're like, no, he's expecting you, and I went. I went, and I probably should have told Hiddleston this story, because I don't, I think it's funny. Maybe he would have been weirded out but I knocked on the door, and he opens the door, and in Crimson Peak, it's a period film, right? So he's wearing the billowy, shirt, whatever. He opens the door, and he's in his undershirt, like it's in this deep V. The wind's blowing his hair, and I'm like, oh my God, this is one of the most handsome men I've ever seen in my
It was
life.
love
It
at
was like a
first sight.
romance cover, fucking come to life. And then we talked in there, and I brought up the fact that I'm like, listen, man, funnily, this is a great set visit because Guillermo's actually shooting things on real stages, and I can see what's going on. I'm just hanging out, and watching filming, which is what I like to do on a movie set. And I said, that wasn't the experience I had last time I saw you work, and that was on Thor 2. And he's like, oh my God, he's like, you know what? You know why that was? Because that was my death scene that they were shooting that day.
Oh my
Because there's a
God.
scene where Loki dies, but they said that the reason why they were freaking out about all the press there is they were still up in the air whether they were going to keep it that way. And so he's like, they literally shot that scene that day as if the character was out of the MCU forever. And then they changed their mind later, I guess, at some
Now he
point.
dies in every movie.
Now he dies in every single one that they do. He dies three times before he gets his own show. So yeah, that's my Tom Hiddleston story. But I was thinking back on, I'm like, so many of the Marvels, Crimson Peak, Life of Chuck, it's weird how Tom Hiddleston's proving to be like the constant on my throughout my journey doing all this. So yeah.
The oddest star interaction or leading man interaction I ever had on set was with Michael Cera on Scott Pilgrim versus the World. And it was neither of our faults. But what happened was I visited, so they're shooting in Toronto, visited the set. I am sitting in Video Village, which is that place with the director's chairs and the video screens. And the publicist says, I think, they're having a break in shooting or whatever. And the publicist says, I'll go off and try to find Michael Cera for you and see if you can do the interview in Video Village. So the publicist leaves. I'm sitting there for another 10 minutes. And then Michael Cera turns up and sits next to me. So I assume that he has been told that I'm here to interview him. Whereas in fact, he had not been told this and had just come and sat, decided to
Oh
sit in
no.
Video Village
She's
and
still
like
off
sit
looking
there.
for him, or the publicist is still
The
looking.
publicist is off looking for him. And I should say, I mean, I've spent a tiny amount of time hanging out with Michael Cera socially and delightful man. But he's not someone who like gets out of bed thinking, fantastic, I get to do 20 interviews today, you know. So he sits down next to me. And I'm like, and the weird thing is, as you'll know this, the start of interviews generally are like you're just introducing yourself to somebody. You know what I mean? And so I'm like, hi, I'm Clark, and how's it going today? And he's like, oh, it's going pretty well, actually. No, it's fine. Yeah, it's great. And we're having this sort of like chit chat. And then he looks down, and I'm holding like a big clunky old school tape recorder with like a TDK 90 in it, with a red light on. And suddenly goes, hold on. Are you recording this? And I'm like, yes. And he goes, what? Why are you recording this? Because from his point of view, this is like incredibly strange. And I'm like, well, because I'm interviewing you. And he's like, you're interviewing me? And it's just the whole thing became, I mean, he didn't get angry, but it was like massive confusion until we sorted
I would be
out
weirded out if somebody
what's
just started
going on.
chatting with me and then I looked out and they were
Sure.
recording it. Like, what? Wait, what are you doing?
Because he must have thought I was crew, or like, I don't know, like a cast member he hadn't been introduced to, whatever, or
Maybe, maybe.
he probably thought I was an executive producer he had to, slightly humor would be my
Yeah,
guess.
you were the maybe you were the Lithuanian money launderer who was underwriting the whole
Yeah.
operation. You never know.
Quite possibly,
Yeah,
quite possibly.
in my experience, everybody on crew assumes that if you're there, because a lot of times with these set visits, you are there in a big gaggle of journalists. For those of us lucky enough to have been, extended the privilege, sometimes you're there by yourself, and when they see one strange new face, they assume you're with the studio. That's like every crew member. I get people that crewed Lord of the Rings thought that I was with New Line because I would get to go hang out because nobody else is getting to go on the set, right? And so they just go, well, nobody else can possibly be here. That has to be somebody
It
important.
must be a Weinstein.
Hey, you hold your damn tongue, don't you dare. But that ties right in with Clark's book. I could trade war stories with you all day here, and you bring up Michael Cera makes me really want to tell my super bad interview story, but we'll save that for another day. Let's talk about your book. You're here with your novel that has that is of deep interest to anybody listening to this show, I would assume. Anybody who's super into Stephen King and the movies made of King's work is going to be interested in this.
I wouldn't call
Oh,
it a
yeah,
novel, though.
just
It's
right.
nonfiction,
Yeah, just
right, Clark? Or
yeah. It's a nonfiction history of the that makes it sound like I've written like a kind of novel
the
about
great
me and
American
Stephen
novel, I
King,
think. Yes.
he wrote
Which
the War and Peace about the 20 years of making horror films.
yeah. So it's called Screaming and Conjuring: the Resurrection and Unstoppable Rise of the Modern Horror Movie. The problem with subtitles is you kind of need them to explain what it is, but then you've got to remember what they are, which can be a bit tricky. And essentially, it's a history of the horror film from Scream in 1996 to The Conjuring in 2013. So, it goes, it sort of shows one wave of film. It shows the various waves of films that were popular during that time, how teen slashers were sort of replaced by J horror, and then what became known as torture porn, although no one who ever made a so-called torture porn movie was happy with that.
No.
And then how there were so many remakes, and then as the 2000s moves on, found footage movies arrive in considerable numbers. And then starting with sort of Paranormal Activity and Insidious, you have like a wave of supernatural movies, which really peaks with the first Conjuring. And that's kind of where I end the tale, because the Conjuring sort of inspired the first $2 billion franchise. And also I think like I can walk you through all the different or the history of the 2000s, but the nearer you get to the modern day, I think it's harder and harder to pass quite what is going on. It's like if you look at horror this year, Sinners is obviously hugely successful and important horror film, but how is it important? What will it lead to? Or is it a one-off? Or so, and it's you kind of need a few years to really understand its place in history, I think. And it's also about the many people who worked on the films, both in front of and behind the camera. And a lot of these people turn up again and again and again. A lot of these people know each other. I mean, you tend to think about filmmakers in the set from the 70s, like Carpenter and Cronenberg, knowing each other, partly probably because they were once interviewed by Mick Garris. I'm not sure on, on camera, I don't know necessarily how much they were. I'm not saying they weren't, but certainly in the 2000s, you had a group of filmmakers. Well, you had two groups of filmmakers, really, the kind of masters of horror filmmakers who were the Hilt filmmakers from the 70s, and then like a younger generation of filmmakers, Edgar Wright, who we've talked about already, Eli Roth, Rob Zombie, Darren Bousman, James Wan, all of whom knew each other to varying degrees. Plus, you have all the special effects artists that worked on these different films, the many actors that pop up again and again, people who sort of have surprising roles in horror, like David Lynch, who was a very much a protege, sorry, who was very much a mentor to Eli Roth. Eli Roth worked for David Lynch for a couple of years. Tom Cruise oddly pops up quite a lot in this book, which I wasn't really expecting. One way and another, he's a, I think, an executive producer or one of the producers, I think, on The Others and then War of the Worlds. And then he takes over briefly, I want to say MGM UA, and starts giving notes on Cabin in the Woods, oddly. And so, yeah, I definitely made an effort. I mean, you want to sort of build characters. You want to lean into making various people sort of familiar to readers, so they pop up again and again. And I tried to do that, as much as possible. I mean, I spoke to Greg Nicotero, the great special makeup effects artist. For like an hour easily. I mean, I'd spoken to him before, but in his case, but he'd worked on like probably 50 movies that I could have included. And that was very much like just me going, well, what about this film? And what about that film? And what about just give me like, so I can sort of pepper these stories through the piece. And it was a lot of fun. And it wasn't, I mean, my thought originally when I talked to my publisher was like, well, maybe we could do the story of the 10 franchises that began during this period. So Scream, I Know What You Did Last Summer, Final Destination, Saw, Insidious, and so forth. And my publisher said, we could do that, but if someone's like doesn't like, I don't know, the Paranormal Activity movies, that's going to be a whole chapter that they're just going to skip. So why don't you sort of, start being less lazy and actually kind of tell this entire story? And I was like, great. Not sort of quite realizing how big a bite of the cake that would be. But yeah, I'm really happy with the way it turned out. And no one's tried to sue me yet, so
Well, it's not yet,
great news.
but it's I think that our listeners will really love this book because it is so wide ranging. Like, this is a dense book. Also, I love this sort of onyx black binding. It's beautifully made. Did you have any say in the look of it and the design and all of that stuff, Clark?
I mean, I'd say no, I didn't. I mean, actually, I mean, I don't know how you feel, Anthony, but or Eric, both of you. But after I've written a piece, I'm like, oh, well. I mean, we don't need even to have a cover for this masterwork. You can just we'll just print it up on A4 paper, staple it together, and send it out to the, hundreds of thousands of people who surely will want to buy this. And my publisher's always like, nah, I think we're gonna do a proper, a hardback version of this. I'm in deep debt to my publisher Matthew at 1984 Publishing, for, as always, insisting that we put the book out, in the best way possible. And also the front cover is art is by Gary Pullin, aka Ghoulish Gary Pullin, who has actually, well, he's designed, he's done a lot of he's done a lot of genre stuff, post, I sorry, I don't mean stuff, he's done a lot of genre art, including most recently he's done the covers for a lot of Stephen King reissues. I'm always trying
Yep.
to help you guys back by naturally bringing this all back to
Please back
Stephen
to
King.
Stephen King.
And to my embarrassment, well, let me backtrack a second. I've been in so many sort of, I've reluctantly taken part in so many meetings that turned into marketing meetings at magazines, and you always hear somebody go, "Yeah, it's an advertorial, but cool. We want it to be cool. You know what I mean? Like everything always has to be cool. No one has ever stood up at a meeting and said, "Yeah, but you know, like this, but like not cool. Let's just not do it cool." And it's always the most idiotic thing because it's not really an instruction. That doesn't help anybody. And we were talking. We had Matthew, my publisher, and myself had a Zoom meeting with Gary, and he was like, "Well, what's the brief?" And to my eternal shame, I heard myself saying, "Well, you know, horror films, but cool." And somehow on that a brief so skimpy that it shames the term brief, he came up with this wonderful cover image. So I'm eternally
Yeah,
grateful
it's
to him
gorgeous.
because it's very hard to kind of sum up, you know, 15 years of horror. How do you? I mean, we did briefly consider. Well, my stupid suggestion was doing a piece of art that was half the ghost face mask and half the Annabelle mask, which I think would have been horrible. So my contribution was to make such a bad suggestion that we decided to just let Gary do it, I think.
Well, what I love about it is it's like it's obviously like this screaming face goes with screaming and conjuring, but it's these nerve endings, but it also looks like the face is forming. It looks like that effect of little organisms forming one bigger thing. And I think this is really the story of how horror itself over these decades that you cover, how they form together, how they re how they sort of amplified each other and built upon each other. Who was the interview? I know you've done a ton of interviews here, so this isn't just you, offering up your opinions or assessments. Like you dive in and tell the story of the storytellers. Who were the people that you were really eager to get, and who was your favorite?
I did it's always fun talking to special effects guys because they don't seem to have any filter. Like they never seem to be worried about not being employed again. And well, there are two stories really. One of which is I spoke with Steve Johnson, who is this absolutely legendary special effects guy who designed, who's most famous for designing. Who's the guy that eats trash in Ghostbusters? Slimer. So
Slimer.
he designed Slimer, and has designed. Has worked on many. You just go to his IMDb page. He's worked on many. Projects, including like a lot of horror movies, but he's like the rock and roll special effects guy, and I got on, and he had lots and lots of great stories. But when I got on the interview, he said something. I mean, he was joking, but I just couldn't use the quote because like it wouldn't seem like he was joking. And I wanted to talk to him about Blade 2. He did the extraordinary sort of, you know, vampire work in Blade 2, and there is a autopsy scene in Blade 2, which he masterminded and is really very gruesome. And Blade 2 was directed by Guillermo del Toro. And I was like, "Tell me about Blade 2." And he's like, "I'll tell you something about Blade 2. Everybody thinks Guillermo del Toro is such a nice guy. That guy's the biggest fucking cocksucker you'll ever meet." He was like, "I busted my balls on that," and he never asked me to work for him again. And he was joking, really. But I just knew sort of from that start that it was going to be a pretty entertaining
That is entertaining. I'm sure Guillermo
conversation.
would laugh at
Yeah. Well,
that
no.
too,
Yes.
and
Yes.
curse
Yes.
him out in Spanish.
But he told this a story that I'd never, I just, I don't think I'd read before or in such detail. That unfortunately, so Steve Johnson has worked on many wildly successful films, but it just happened that most of the horror films that he'd worked on during the period I was writing about ended in disaster. As he point, at one point he was like, "Why are you asking me about all my disasters?" And I'm like, "Well, I'm sorry, but it's just like the way this has panned out." And he worked on Dreamcatcher. He worked on the much maligned and very unsuccessful adaptation of Dreamcatcher. And he said, and I don't know if you remember, but there was one, well, I'm sure you do remember, but I don't know if listeners remember, there was one point where Damian Lewis is carrying a dog, which is like full of alien stuff, towards a reservoir. Am I remembering this correctly, Eric?
Yep,
And
that's the
so
finale. Yeah.
Damian Lewis is carrying, they designed this mechanical German Shepherd. And so it looked just like a German Shepherd, but had like stuff squirming around inside. So Steven Johnson built this, and he was saying the problem was that he's used to like warm weather because he lives in LA, and they were shooting like somewhere very cold. So he took the dog, arrived wherever they were shooting. He took the dog to set, and didn't keep it somewhere warm enough. And over the night, ice crystals formed on the mechanics inside the dog. So what they get up the next morning, they strap the dog to Damian Lewis. This is not a stuntman job. And then they press a button or whatever, and the dog just bursts into flames. Hence Damian Lewis bursts into flames. And I was like, what did you do then? He's like, oh, well, then we got a lot of Poland spring water and emptied it out over Damian Lewis. He's like, we didn't kill Damian Lewis. You would have heard about that. But then we had to
Wow.
fix the dog and, so that was, yeah, that was, he's the man that set Damian Lewis on fire,
With
and
a
Dreamcatcher.
with an alien
With a
in his
mechanic,
truck.
yeah, with a alien stuffed mechanical dog.
Hey, this week's episode is brought to you by Welgo USA's thrilling new shark survival thriller, Beast of War, hitting select theaters and digital on October 10th. During World War II, a group of Australian recruits crosses the dangerous Timor Sea until their boat is destroyed. Stranded on a shrinking life raft, the survivors must battle for their lives against a massive, relentless shark. Now, I got to see this at Fantastic Fest this year, and I can tell you it's a super fun movie that isn't in the script, but I wanted to give it a personal recommendation on top of the ad copy. You actually give a shit about these characters. It's a little heightened and weird and funny. I had a great time with this. The shark is ginormous. It has a personality. It even kind of screams, and you'll understand why when you see the movie. I had a blast with this one. I think you will too. From the director of Sting, Kia Roche-Turner, and starring Mark Cole Smith, Joel Nankervis, and Maximilian Johnson, Beast of War is a heart-pounding survival story you won't want to miss. Catch the terror on October 10th. Now let's get back to the show. There's always the interviews that you get that you know, it's like, this is gold. This is going to be the stuff that really that people remember from this. But then there's also the interviews that you get that have to be high profile enough. It's kind of like casting an indie movie almost, right? Where it's like you need that high profile interview to give you the clout. We were talking briefly before we were recording about the missed oral history thing that I wrote for Slash Film, and that one I remember going like, well, I was able to get a lot of the actors and stuff, but it wasn't until I got Tom Jane and actually nailed down Frank Darabont where they were like, oh shit, this is real. Like that's when they went from like, all right, you can, have fun doing some of this on your off time if it's a slow news night or whatever, to this is a real thing, you have these things, we have to go forward. Did you have those interviews as well at all with your either for you or for the publisher where it was like, bam, all right, now you get that, we've hit that mark.
I mean, the good thing was that fortunately, I mean, I interviewed about 50 people for this book, but I also relied on interviews that I'd done, over the 18 years at Entertainment Weekly. So where possible, or if there seemed to be any point to it, I would try to get new interviews. And I was pretty lucky getting hold of a lot of people. But I had those, I had, older stuff to rely on as well. But also, so new interviews, old interviews, but also I did rely on a lot of secondary sources. In many cases, Fangoria. Fangoria is just so, I'm not, I'm aware of the name of the network on which we're on, but I was astounded. I mean, what was interesting? So the British Film Institute has a library in London where I happened to be when I was writing the book. And the thing is, I'm used to research libraries. I know how they work. And what happens when it's obscure periodicals? Not that Fangoria is obscure, but in the world of libraries, maybe it's a little. It's not the New York Times. Sorry to say, should be not. And what usually happens is you go in and they're like, "Yeah, I think we've got like October 79 and maybe some issues in the mid 80s and some of the more recent stuff." But they're not here. They're in storage somewhere else. And if you give us 2 days, we'll see what we can do. And that's kind of what I was anticipating with the not knowing how fantastic the BFI Reuben Library is in London. And what actually happened was I walked in, and there was a lady behind the counter, and I said, "Hi, I'm writing a book about horror." And what I thought I was going to have to say is writing a book about horror. There is a magazine called Fangoria, and I was hoping, I was expecting them to say, "Fango, what's his name?" And but I walked in and I said, "I'm writing a book about horror. I'd like, do you have any Fangorias?" And she just went, "They're over there." And I looked across, and I went to like the corner of the library, and there was every Fangoria bound on shelves, and it was just like the best thing. But the thing is, I mean, it used to be a monthly. And was a very, I mean, I know Fangoria is a very thick magazine, but it used to be thick with like that month's movies, and that's really what it was. And it wasn't like, I'm not saying this is better or worse, but it wasn't like a lot of ruminations on horror history. There was some of that, but it was like Darkness Falls is coming out. Here's, so we're going to put Darkness Falls on the cover, and there's going to be an 8-page article inside discussing all the behind the scenes trials and tribulations of making Darkness Falls. And this will probably be one of certainly two or possibly three articles they'd have on the film over the course of several months. So it's just a vast amount of fantastic information that took me like.
At the moment coverage, which is very interesting. It's like you said, it's not a look back. It's this is the stuff as it's unfolding, and before anybody loved or hated or whatever this thing, it is just a snapshot for that time.
And also a lot of it is, sometimes, somebody would Kevin Williamson would be saying something, about about making Scream or whatever. And then you could sort of see sometimes over time, or because I've spoken to Kevin Williamson, like his story might have changed, and I don't over the years. And I don't mean for a second he's lying, but people, the more people tell stories, they can change, or people forget, and blah blah blah. But this was like the raw stuff, like from the time, and that was really, that was just incredibly useful.
I find that's true too, especially when you get 3 or 4, maybe 5 decades away. It's hard to find anybody who's still alive if their movie is 50 years old, but the more time that passes, you're right. Memories fade. They don't really remember. There are one or two stories that stand out, but those historical records from the early interviews, those are golden.
Can I
And
share one of my
yes,
favorite examples
please.
of that I've gotten to use? And this is I know it's the wrong show. We keep talking about Steven Spielberg, but I did a big series on my love of Temple of Doom on Ain't It Cool back in the day. And I got a lot. Frank Marshall sat down with me. I talked to Gloria Katz and Willard Hayek, who wrote the script. I got all this stuff, and I'm like, I'm just celebrating this movie. It was one of the anniversaries, 25th or whatever the fuck it ended up being. And I'm like, I had interviewed Spielberg before. I was in touch with his office. I know he doesn't like this movie, but it's a movie of his I just adore, that I have since I was a kid. And I reached out. And they're like, "Well, he probably isn't gonna do it, but we'll see." And then ultimately, I got the he's too busy notification on it. So what I did is I dug through my collection, my Temple of Doom collection, and I bought the American Cinematographer issue that came out that was focused on Temple of Doom. And it had, like you were saying, it's like finding gold. There's like an 8-page interview with Steven Spielberg about it. And this is before the movie comes out. It's before all the backlash from the parents groups. It's before, he went on record as being, oh, this movie's too dark. It's more George's movie than my movie, before all this stuff. And it's young, excited, so psyched to be talking about this movie, his newest Indiana Jones. What could possibly go wrong? Everybody's going to love it as much as Raiders, right? It just young, excited Spielberg. So I knew doing the series, I'm like, I can't have Spielberg not his voice not in here, because there were essays, there were all this stuff, but it was mo you know he was the one voice missing. So I took a lot of his quotes from that story and from that interview and put it in the piece, and then I hit publish, and then I was off on like some junket in DC, and as I was writing all this stuff, I remember writing on the bus and finishing the story, and I posted it, and then like 3 hours later, I'm going down to meet a bunch of other journalists to go visit the Lincoln Monument, or we were all just getting together to go sightsee, but at night, and it was like 9 or 10 p.m., and then you look at my email on my phone, and I got a letter from Steven Spielberg about essentially going, hey, what, so sorry I couldn't make this work. And listen, it didn't come from him. It wasn't like Steven.Spielberg@Amblin.com or whatever, but it was his assistant said the bot. I remember this and I always will. The email was from his office saying a message from the boss. And it was, an email that Spielberg had typed up and then said, send this to this guy. And it was essentially going, yeah, it was great seeing great, I'm so sorry I couldn't make it work. And it was great reading and going back through like the man I was at the time of that interview and all this stuff. He's like, I will always, have a fondness for Temple of Doom, for the craft, that put in it. I'm proud of the craft. It just was, I didn't have the personal connection that I would have with the later, with Last Crusade or whatever, and so it was really nice, but to your point, I'm bringing this up, one, to brag about getting a fucking email from Steven Spielberg,
Sure.
which I'll do at any in any moment, but also to point out, like, yeah, it was so invaluable to look at that. Every interview that Spielberg had done about Temple of Doom past that is all him shit talking the movie because of the reception of it, because whatever all the events that led to him disliking it. And I cornered Harrison Ford about this on Ender's Game, on the Ender's Game set, when we were chatting, and it essentially was like, I think Temple of Doom's radically underrated, and I am a big fan of it, and Harrison said he was too, but like what he said was that Spielberg was so bummed out by by the reception, specifically among parents' rights groups, and how he it really affected him deeply whenever he was accused of purposefully hurting children, that he's like that forever tainted his view on the movie, and I think that that's right. So there is a value. This is my long roundabout
This is a long story,
way.
Eric.
It is a very long story,
That's
but it's my
perfect.
it's the roundabout way to talk about, just how valuable it was finding his words at the time, and how you're right that Empire kind of does it now, but there's like very few other outlets that are, documents of the period, that can act as a snapshot of that time and place. So, yeah.
Yeah. On the completely the other end of the spectrum, I found a letter the other day which said, "Dear Clark, thank you for your kind words, Kevin Spacey." And
That
was
was
like,
from
last
something you
week.
recently said, then,
Yeah.
right?
Yes, yes,
Did
yes,
you write a letter
yes.
to the judge, or was there?
No, it was like 1998, and it took me a while to remember, but I think I was trying to. I used to freelance for Mojo magazine, which is a great music magazine, and we would have a page where it'd be three famous people talking about their musical choices. And I think I was trying, I'd definitely seen The Iceman Cometh with Kevin Spacey in the lead. And I think I was kind of buttering him up, hopefully, hoping that he would talk about his musical choices for Mojo. To be clear, this was like 1998. This was like a long time ago. But yeah, I mean, definitely for the book, there are some people that I interviewed. Not many, but there are some people that I interviewed, and they would start talking about a film that I had not, that I did not think I was going to do a section on, and I wound up doing a section on. And actually, I think there were two movies that this happened were directed by Patrick Lussier, who is not really a household name, but he's possibly most famous for being Stephen King, not Stephen King, Wes Craven's editor. So he edited, for 20 years, edited all of Wes Craven's movies, including Scream and Scream 2, Cursed. But then he simultaneously had a directing career, and he one of his I think his second film he directed was a film called Dracula 2000,
I remember
which
that.
stars Gerard Butler as Dracula and Christopher Plummer as Van Helsing and Johnny Lee Miller as Van Helsing's protege. And I had no recollection of this film, I have to say, whatsoever. But it was, I mean, it did quite a lot of business. But what was interesting was that, so it was produced by Dimension, Bob Weinstein's company. And what happened was, like, in February 1999, Bob Weinstein decided that what people really needed to see was a film called Dracula 2000. But it had to come out. Oh, wait, I beg your pardon. So it would have been February 2000, I guess. Yeah, so it would be February 2000. He decides he wants to make a film called Dracula 2000, but it has to come out that year, right? Because, you know, it's no point releasing a film called Dracula 2000 in 2001. So he gets Patrick Lussier, because, you know, Scream had also been a Dimension movie, and Patrick Lussier is now tasked with coming up with the actual film, including the screenplay, and shoot it and edit it and release it within like 10 months, which is an incredibly short period of time. Made worse by the fact that he and his writing partner came up with the script, and then Bob Weinstein insisted that it be rewritten by both Scott Derrickson, later to direct Doctor Strange and Sinister, and Aaron Kruger, who was the screenwriter of The Ring, amongst other things. And so Patrick was just saying, so he had to like sit on his hat, like he knew that he had to start building all this stuff, or, you know, I mean, time was ticking away, while, you know, other hands reworked this script, for a film called Dracula 2000. So it's not like anyone's ever going to, you know, be winning an Oscar for this thing in all likelihood.
It didn't win. Was it nominated?
No. And he was like, he was like, I don't want to throw Aaron Kruger under the bus. And he paused and he goes, mind you, I don't mind throwing him under the bus, the amount of money we paid him. And so he's just telling all these stories, and then Bob Weinstein gets involved in post-production. And there's actually, there is quite a good Entertainment Weekly story from the time about all this. And so you know, and so he just made the deadline. It came out in like mid-December 2000. What I always find hilarious is it came out in mid-December 2000 in the US, but in a few foreign territories, it came out in 2001, where they just retitled it Dracula 2001, which, you know, would have seemed like an easy solve right from the start, because there's actually nothing about
Then
it
when it came out in
that, that,
4K,
you
it was
know.
Dracula 2022.
Yeah,
And
yeah,
it
yeah,
was
yeah,
part of
yeah.
a
Because it's
tradition.
not
What,
like
weren't there like a bunch of Hammer films? It was like Dracula 1972 and
AD,
stuff like that. But it's not like anyone stands around going, my recollection is not that anyone stands around going, Dracula in the year 2000, you know, and even if they And even if they had, you could have fixed that in ADR. And then during the remake craze, Patrick directed My Bloody Valentine 3D, which I saw at the time and I rewatched when I was writing the book. And it's actually quite a lot of fun. But again, this time, because it was both the remake craze, this is when the remake craze collided with the 3D craze. So suddenly Patrick is having to go down like real life mines, carrying what he described as like refrigerator sized cameras and, you know, shoot everything on location. So that was another book that I wrote, you know, a section about that I didn't, you know, I'm not, there were some films like Dracula, particularly Dracula 2000, that I don't think is, with the best will in the world, an important film in its own right, and certainly didn't really influence other filmmakers. But I was just like, well, I gotta spend three pages,
It's
you know,
fun. Yeah, it's a fun
covering
story.
this. Yeah. And that's how you end up with a 500-page book in the end.
It's not a very fertile area for Stephen King adaptations, but he turns up a lot through the book. And You do have a wonderful section about Frank Darabont's The Mist. I think we should talk about before we let you go. But what struck me is that he does turn up regularly as a voice of authority on horror. And he's cited early on. I know your book starts with Scream, but some of the filmmakers in the years that followed Scream were saying, you know, who was a good advocate for horror is Stephen King. And they mentioned that he spoke up about Evil Dead. He wrote, I think he wrote and like a
he wrote, yeah, he was at Cannes in I think 82 when Evil Dead screened in Cannes, and Stephen King wrote an article basically saying, yeah, very much, you know, I've seen the new boy genius of horror, and it's Sam Raimi, and that helped get the film a distribution deal. I mean, I almost feel like I repeatedly lent on Stephen King. And Stephen King's, I mean, I did not. Stephen King's both a character and a sort of, I use him as almost like a historian or a critic. I mean, the great thing about Stephen King, I mean, so Stephen King was a columnist at Entertainment Weekly when I was working there. And also when you were working there, Anthony?
Yeah.
He was
still writing. No, he stopped right before I started. Right. I remember being really disappointed about that.
And he would write, it was Stephen King wrote a column every 3 weeks, I think, and then it was Diablo Cody and our colleague Dalton Ross and maybe somebody else, but they were sort of rotate columns. And to be honest, it was funny because there would always be competition to write for the magazine. I mean, it had a big staff, even though it's weekly. You know, you'd always be trying to get in, and not that I begrudge Stephen King the space, but I would always be aware that there were weeks when he was writing more than me for the magazine. plus, like, this was just something he did in between, you know, like writing a book and a half before lunch and then three short stories afterwards, you know. Mm. And then I'm sort of like, you know, handing in my, 80 word Fountains of Wayne review or whatever. I love the Fountains of Wayne. But he would write three types of columns. One of which would be, he'd get really angry about something. And I'm trying to think of a good example, but like there'd be some commentator on Fox or whatever would say something, and it would just be a whole column of him like you know, really angry about stuff, which was fantastic. And then at the other end of the spectrum, he'd write a column about how he really enjoyed the fourth album by some country rock band that he liked. And you'd sort of be like, yeah, we don't really, I mean, you know, all due respect, it's, you know, but then actually quite often I would then play the album and I'd be like, Stephen King's got a point on this too. But then he'd do these columns where he'd sort of talk about contemporary horror. And I love people who are sort of in the industry talking about, you know, the film industry. And I know King does, you know, now sort of keep himself at arm's length, but you know, he is kind of an insider, and I there was stuff that he wrote that I used. I used a lot of those columns in the book, and also stuff he wrote for Fangoria, and he wrote a great column once about how Hollywood doesn't know how to do horror, and this was possibly towards the end of a particularly lean period of Stephen King horror adaptations.
Right.
But it was basically all about how great The Strangers was, mm-hmm. which I do a section of in the book. And it's interesting. I think if The Strangers came out now and was similarly successful, there'd be like 110,000 like internet posts about various aspects of it. Mm-hmm. But this was still, this was like, what, 2007? And this was basically where a film could turn up, you know, be reviewed, I guess, but then make a bit of money at the box office and then just disappear, right? I mean, that can happen quite a lot. Hence, you know, I mean, a lot of these films I'm writing about, I had sort of half forgotten. Not that I've half forgotten about The Strangers, but certainly a lot of the remakes mm-hmm. I'd forgotten existed. But Stephen King wrote a whole column about how you didn't need money to make, how horror was actually hurt by making money, by you didn't need a lot of money to make a frightening movie. And as an example, he said one of the most frightening things he'd seen was Liv Tyler, like running away from these masked maniacs and The Strangers and trying to hide under a bed and not being able to fit under the bed. And to be clear, like there was only about an inch space. He wasn't like suggesting, you know, Liv Tyler was large or anything. And yeah, and I just, I mean, I would, the book, I do not really give my opinions about the films in the book. I sort of assess more. I mean, I mention how they got made, how much money they made, and then,
What their reception was.
yeah, what the reception was and how perhaps they helped move the story of horror along. But there were definitely times when I'm like, huh, I just want to hit on the, I want to do a hit on the ruins. I don't want to write a section about it. And The Ruins is another sort of half-forgotten movie, but it's a really great and really gruesome movie about a bunch of people discovering some weird pyramid out in the middle of a jungle with like man-eating and talking vines. And these people get like their bodies torn apart by this thing. And Stephen King liked it, and I think he had written about it for Fangoria. So I was basically like, well, let's hand it over to Stephen King for a couple of sentences. I mean, you can't really go wrong.
No, he talks about the ruins, Shaun of the Dead in your book, Frailty, which I think is a great Bill Paxton movie, a great movie in
Absolutely
general.
great. Yeah.
He turns up again and again as a guy, almost like if your book is the Bible of horror from this era, he comes down like a little heavenly host and says, "I bless this. This is a wonderful thing." And then everybody flocks to it because he has such influence over people.
But then there is also this interesting thing that Stephen King, horror movies based on Stephen King works fell out of fashion. And so by the mid 90s, or certainly by the early 2000s, what you have is a lot of, or you've had a lot of great successful movies based on non-horror Stephen King books. And I think the pivot point for this is whatever year it was in the 80s when you have Maximum Overdrive released and Dying a Death at the box office, and then a month later you have Stand By Me coming out and obviously becoming one of the most beloved movies of all time. And I'm speaking broadly, but that's the point where people, where filmmakers, where producers kind of pivoted away from big screen Stephen King horror and moved into big screen Stephen King kind of dramas. So, and then you have The Shawshank Redemption, The Green Mile, Hearts in Atlantis, so on and so forth. While the horror movies are of the ilk of, The Night Flyer and The Mangler, and I don't, you know,
The
it's,
Children of the
I,
Corn sequels and
the children of, that's the thing, and that's because I'm old enough to remember that in a strange way, Stephen King started beginning to feel a bit naff when it came to horror. And there's no guarantee. I mean, obviously nowadays, I think kids today, they wouldn't believe you if you told them this, but there is a world where we didn't get It and It Part Two and the remake of Graveyard Shift and all of these successful Stephen King horror movies just because he had fallen permanently out of fashion. And what I so and while there were adaptations of Stephen King horror books, they were miniseries on TV. I mean, I'm telling you stuff you already know, but Mick Garris cranking out these hugely entertaining tales, but on the small screen. And then in the early 2000s, you have this sort of sputtering attempt to start getting Stephen King horror back on the big screen. And I kind of trace the maybe I'm getting the chronology slightly wrong, but David Koepp makes Secret Window with Johnny Depp, which is pretty much a horror movie. And it kind of turns a profit, but people, I mean, I remember seeing it at the cinema and being like, I think I know where this is going after like 20 minutes. And then it's not the most satisfying film in the world. Although, the actors are kind of hoots and I got no particular problem with it. And then Mick Garris makes Riding the Bullet, which is also a lot of fun, which is a lot of fun, but it does not get released really in any substantial fashion whatsoever. And then they make Dreamcatcher, which is obviously a huge disaster. And so at that point, you could really imagine them just stopping doing it. And then there's that 1-2 punch. To be fair, the Dimension produced 1-2 punch, a first 1408, which is a huge success. And then The Mist, which is less successful, but I kind of almost subconsciously present in the book as like, all right. this is scary as shit. Like, this is like, you know, a Stephen King, this is one of the weirdest, nastiest Stephen King tales, like brought to the big screen, pretty much intact. Or if it's changed, it's changed in a way that he makes it even, you know, weirder and more extreme. And although it's not a hit because against everybody's, against the wishes of Frank Darabont and Thomas Jane and everybody else, Bob Weinstein decided to release it on Thanksgiving. Because what people want to see after eating a turkey dinner is, you know, a load of people in a supermarket being molested by weird prehistoric stuff creatures and then blowing their own brains out. You know, it wasn't a success, but I think, you know, I think that stuck around in the consciousness and gained a cult following. So, and there is then a bit of a lull, admittedly, but I think that kind of those two films really carried the torch of Stephen King horror on the big screen. And then by the 2010s, people are ready to sort of mount it and then you're just off to the races with a new generation of stuff. And there's the great quote, which again I stole from, actually I think this was the AP or somebody, where they have a press conference for The Mist, and Stephen King says, you know, my films were kind of in my horror films were kind of in rehab, but now, you know, I'm you know, now they're a bit better. And I think that's, you know, that is the film that kind of did it.
You mentioned back there a ways that there was a remake of Graveyard Shift. Did you mean Pet Sematary? Or were you
I'm
talking?
sorry. Yes, Pet
Or did I
Sematary.
miss a Graveyard Shift
No,
remake? I was just like, wait a second,
no,
there might
no,
be
no, no. I beg your pardon. You're absolutely right, Pet Sematary, yeah.
he had one of those columns for Entertainment Weekly where he talked about this era and how they weren't making new versions of his new films based on any of his books, past or present. And that it was all sequels, and he talked about the Children of the Corn sequels and how annoyed he was by them. I presume he must still get paid, or maybe that's outside of his control. Like he doesn't seem to mind stopping things if he can, but that aren't necessarily beneficial to him, but or aren't true adaptations. But he mentioned this something. Sometimes They Come Back, which was a TV movie with Tim Matheson, and I think the mid-90s. Pretty good for a TV movie, I think. That's like an entertaining watch on a Tuesday night. But he goes, you know, then they made Sometimes They Come Back for More, Sometimes They Come Back Again. And he said, by now I remember this line, by now I expect Sometimes They Come Back for great service and low, low prices.
No, you're absolutely right. But what I remember is going into block my memories of going into Blockbuster and those movies, The Children of the Corn, sometimes, you know, Sometimes They Come Back, maybe Night Flyer, certainly the Mangler 2 as well, right? Very
2.0,
much.
baby. Yeah.
Very much being on the metaphorical bottom shelf, and quite likely the actual, you know, bottom
Yeah.
shelf,
Night Flyer is
so that
pretty
if
good.
people.
I hadn't seen it until recently, and Eric recommended it.
Yeah.
That holds up as a fun kind of HBO. It reminds me almost like of the old Tales from the Crypt or Tales from the Dark
Yeah.
Side
It definitely has
shows.
that Dream On aesthetic from that era of
Yeah.
HBO for sure. But like, yeah,
Well,
it's you talk about the weird stuff, and that's the stuff that lives, right? Because
yeah.
Miguel Ferrer being a sleazy tabloid reporter chasing down a vampire flying a Cessna, you know, it's like, you know, it's so bizarre, and you get a great character actor like Miguel Ferrer getting, you know, his time to shine. You
He's
know, I have a
wonderful in
big
it. He's
soft
a
spot for him.
wonderful asshole in that movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But also, I think, I mean, this is what another reason why I didn't want to start giving my opinions about horror movies is that, I mean, I think horror fans, there comes, I mean, horror fans can be quite crossed-armed with new horror, but anything that's 20 years ago, there's a fan base for everything. You know what I mean? And you know, if I'd seen, well, I mean, if I'd seen The Night Flyer, not to pick on The Night Flyer because it is a lot of fun, but if I'd seen, I don't know, The Mangler 2 in, you know, 1998, and it was presented to me as like, you know, this is a new film worthy of your attention, I would probably watch it and think, this is not a film worthy of my attention. But give me two beers and put on The Mangler 2 right now, and I'm going to be having a good time, I figure, you know. I don't know if my girlfriend's gonna be having a good time, but I suspect I will.
Yeah, I might challenge you to that one, but then you'd put on Mangler 3 and go, man, give me Mangler 2. Where's Mangler 2? So.
Yeah,
sure.
The good old days of Mangler 2.
Yeah.
I think we got to wrap up soon, but Clark, we're kind of starting at the end now with or ending with the beginning. What's your Stephen King origin story? When did you first become aware of this guy?
It's funny. I listened to the so I just find that my memory about everything that happened before breakfast on any particular day is very hazy. I listened to the Bret Easton Ellis podcast, and he's always like, "Yeah, I can remember seeing this some obscure Doris Day movie at this particular cinema at 2 o'clock in the afternoon on October 31st in 1971, and the weather was this and that." I'm a bit hazy, but I do, having said which, I do clearly remember, when I was a big reader when I was a kid, I remember getting my hands on a copy of The Shining, but there was this odd thing where you're supposed to ask teachers permission to read books. I mean, not to read books generally, but specific books, if they were like naughty books. And I guess I would have been about 11, and I presented a copy of The Shining to my English teacher, Mrs. Nash. Miss Nash, I can't remember. And she looked at the opening page, and I think the first line, there's a swear word in it. I wouldn't.
Officious little prick in the genre.
There you go. Boom. There you go. And she just looked at it and was like, yeah, this is fine. And handed it back to me. And that was it. But what's slightly interesting is I'm 57. And when I started getting into Stephen King, he was not a revered figure in the culture. Like he had written, I don't know, he'd probably written like five published books. And I mean, I loved him, but this was like 1979. And Stephen King was, I mean, I'm not sure. I mean, when I don't even know who I would have been thinking, who I would have gotten this from. But my memory is that, horror was regarded as trash, and he was regarded as a trash author. And also had not, I mean, while all of the books he'd written by that point in retrospect were incredible, Carrie, The Shining, and Christine. So on. Yeah, like, it wasn't like this, Christine, it wasn't like this massive body of work, I mean, it's more books than I'll ever write. But it wasn't, I've never sort of been in awe of Stephen King in that particular way. Like, he's never been like a giant to me in the same way that actors, who were around and put together a body of work before I was an adult seem like loom much larger in my consciousness than actors that I kind of grew up with. And to be clear, I have read. By Stephen King is the author that I have read by far the most. And I keep up with Stephen King. I love I've been thoroughly enjoying the Holly books. But he's not like a Mount Rushmore character to me. He is this guy that I feel I sort of grew up with, even though he's, quite a lot older than, or somewhat older than me. And that's always kind of been fun. So I've enjoyed the sort of enshrinement of Stephen King. I find that absolutely, fabulous and amazing. But I mean, and as you guys know, he's just great to chat to, Right. And I've never, and I have a horrible suspicion that I told this last time I was on, but I interviewed him for the book about the sniper that I'm. It's about a guy. He's a hitman.
Billy Summers.
Billy Summers. I interviewed him for Billy Summers. I told you I had a terrible memory, which is great for a historian. And so
that's why you write it down, so you don't have to remember it. Sean Connery would say. Yeah.
But he's always as interested in what you're doing as, like, he'll give you all the quotes about whatever you're asking him about. But he's always like, "What are you? What have you been watching?" And so he was, we're winding down at the interview. He's like, "What have you been watching?" And I'd just been watching this fascinating three-part documentary about snooker. It's like, I don't know if you have snooker, but it's like pool, essentially. It's a different version of billiards. But in the 80s, it became like wildly popular in Britain, huge, like one of the most popular sports. And the Canadian team were famous, like in retrospect, substance abusers. Two of them were massive cokeheads, and then there was this enormously fat guy called Bill Werbeneck, who said that his doctor insisted that he had to drink 12 pints of beer a day or something, which meant that he was allowed, and we had a doctor's note, which meant he could, because they were trying to turn snooker into like a respectable sport. And so you weren't allowed to drink, or certainly not drink like vast numbers of beer at the table. And he had a doctor's note. But it was just a fascinating age of sport for snooker. And I just watched this. And I was telling Stephen King all about this. And to this day, I'm waiting for him to write a story about like a haunted pool table. That would be my, you know what I mean? That he's like put this away in the back of his brain and he's watched the documentary and he's like, I gotta haunted pool cue. How about that? You know, I don't think it's ever gonna happen, but that's always my hope.
Well, Clark Hollis, thank you for being on the show with us. It's been fun to reunite with you and reminisce with you. And congrats on the book. It's called
Thank
Screaming
you.
and Conjuring. Can you remember the subtitle?
It's Screaming and Conjuring, the Resurrection and Unstoppable Rise of the Modern Horror Movie.
You got
I can,
it. You remember the title?
I can do it, but I can't yet do it without sort of obviously fumbling around in the cobwebbed attic of my brain for for the whole thing.
Well, you'll get it down just in time for the sequel, which will have an even longer
Yes,
subtitle.
almost definitely. Yes. But guys, thank you. Thank you. The problem with writing a book is you're stuck in a room for 2 years and then nice folks like you ask me to go on podcasts and then I just shout for an hour and a half because I haven't really
Oh, we like
had
that.
anybody to talk to. So I hope
But
that's
did you
detailed.
tell
And
a
you
five
conjure.
yeah, but did you tell a 5-minute story about getting an email from Steven Spielberg? No. Got
No, I
you.
did not. I
It
did
was a good
not. I
story,
did
Eric. It was
not.
a good
Okay, good.
story. it's okay if you shout for an hour. My cat, I don't know if anybody hears, if anybody hears any weird high-pitched screaming in the background, I don't know if the mic picked it up, but my cat decides when she's hungry and starts screeching. So no animals are abused. They're just nagging for their food. So that's all right. That's your screaming and conjuring. We've got the
There we
screaming down.
go.
It's just the
Fantastic.
right ambiance. Again, Clark, thank you so much for all you've done for the show and for the continued support and for putting out these really fucking rad books. And I got to say, one last Stephen King connection. The vibe that I'm getting reading this book is very much the same vibe I have reading Danse Macabre. You know, where
Oh, well,
you're
that's
having
comparison.
a very specific section of, a hyper focused, and the fact that, like you said, we're not, it's not just the big movies, it's also these little one-off things that you may or may not have seen. I might not have a memory of seeing it until I go, oh shit, yeah, I remember when that came out, kind of thing. Exactly the way, I would get reading the Stephen King book, but about the stuff he grew up with, 50, 60, 70s stuff, so.
So just wait, we can put Better Than Danse Macabre on the paperback. Is that Better Than Danse Macabre, Eric Vespe? Better Than Stephen King, Eric Vespe on the. We'll come back to you. We'll
Well,
talk to you.
and
I'll get
put Anthony
my.
Bresnikan in there just to cover my ass a little bit in case Uncle Steve sees it. So,
many thanks to Clark Collis for jumping in here to nerd out about the state of horror in general and King's continuing place among the elite of horror. As you're listening to this, I'm off to get hitched. The wedding day is this weekend and the honeymoon is right after, so I'll be off the grid for a bit, but that doesn't mean we're leaving you high and dry. No siree, Bob. In 2 weeks' time, we'll have the next KingCast up as scheduled, and it's a doozy. Finally, we have Andy and Barbara Muschietti coming on to talk about all things It, with a focus on their upcoming HBO prequel series, Welcome to Derry. It's a great chat with two dyed-in-the-wool Stephen King nerds, and I can't wait for y'all to hear it. Also, on our Patreon this Friday, our patrons are getting a new commentary track, this time for Brian De Palma's Carrie, where Bresnikan and I are joined by the Year of Underrated Stephen King podcast host, Kim C., to talk about feminism, strict religious moms, shower period, 70s bush, and of course, the incredible perm hairstyle of all the men in the movie. If you're not already signed up to the Patreon, you can do so at patreon.com/thekingcast. It's the single best way to help support the show, and patrons get Discord access, 5 years worth of bonus episodes, and access to all the newest bonus material as well. Patreon.com/thekingcast. Sign up. All right. Until next time, adios, folks. The KingCast is hosted by Eric Vespi, that's me, and Anthony Bresnikin. The show is produced by myself as well as Abby Goel and Tara Ansley, and is distributed by the Fangoria Podcast Network. Daniel Danger is our art director, and the show was created by me, the late, great Scott Wampler.